All right. The next episode here of the Cascade Hiker Podcast features Greg Johnston. He's on the show talking about he's the author of Washington's Pacific Coast, a guide to hiking, camping, fishing, and other adventures. So we're going to talk a lot about the Pacific Coast, but he was also one of the outdoor writers for the Seattle PI. We'll talk about it, but it's no longer. Now we're going to find out what he's doing today and what's on his plate for future hikes. So go on over to the show notes at CascadeHikerPodcast.com and follow along. You're going to find links to some of the stuff we talked about and some pictures of Greg on the trail. Here is the Cascade Hiker Podcast. This is the Cascade Hiker Podcast. You're going to find out all the aspects of hiking in our beautiful Pacific Northwest woods.
I'm a country boy with a soft side. My heart wanders up north to the hillside. And I've never met anyone quite as beautiful as you.
Check us out over at CascadeHikerPodcast.com. That's right, CascadeHikerPodcast.com. That's where you're going to find all the show notes and links right there.
Enigmatic like that of the cosmos. Never held.
I want to thank Whiskey Fever for letting me use that awesome track there. That was Tall Grass off their album, Gonna Wake Up This Whole Town. Find them at ReverbNation.com/Whiskey Fever. They're from Cedral Woolley. Go check them out. I'm your host, Rudy Getzik. I put this podcast together to inspire you to get out on the trail. Are you putting in 2-mile hikes, 5-mile hikes? You sitting on the couch? Have you even gone on a backpacking trip yet? I'm going to introduce you to some folks that have done that and a whole lot more. So without further ado, here is the Cascade Hiker Podcast. Next on the Cascade Hiker Podcast, what's your name and where are you from?
Greg Johnston. I am from Kirkland, Washington.
Okay. And you got quite a history. I met you up in Darrington at a book thing there at the Mountain Loop Books and Coffee.
Coffee and Books, I think.
Tony down there.
Yeah.
He's a good guy. And so you're showcasing your book, and man, I fell in love with it.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, the book is called Washington's Pacific Coast, A Guide to Hiking, Camping, Fishing, and Other Adventures. And basically, it's a project that I took up while I was unemployed. I worked for 25 years for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer as the outdoors writer. And in 2009, the PI died. They closed the print editions. It now exists as a website only. So they laid off most of the reporting staff, well, most of the entire staff. And so in 2009, for the first time in my adult life, I found myself unemployed with one basic marketable skill, I guess you would say, and that is writing. So I've had a history with the ocean since I was about 5 years old. My folks used to take us, the family, out for vacation. We'd spend a week out at Calalock every year from the time I was, I don't know, maybe 3, 4, 5 until I was fully grown. So, you know, the ocean was just magic to me. Calalock is a wonderful place, of course. And so I have a long history there. And then also in 1978, I started a 4-year stint as a reporter on the Daily World newspaper in Aberdeen, which is near the coast. So I had a chance to approach the coast as a journalist. Got to do a lot of fun stories about, you know, loggers and fishermen and various projects that were going on there that had potential impacts to the environment. The Indian fishing rights controversy was raging at the time. So anyway, I was able to report on things happening along the coast. At the same time, my dad was co-owner of a salmon fishing charter service at Westport. So I, you know, got to rub elbows with crusty fishermen and go out salmon fishing a lot and do stories on salmon trollers and Indian gillnetters. So I got to know the coast really well. And in my time at the PI, I came to realize, because I got sent just about every outdoors book on the Northwest by publishers, that there really didn't exist a good comprehensive guide to the Washington coast. You know, occasionally people would call me up and say, hey, what's a good guidebook to the Washington coast? Well, we have plenty of good hiking guidebooks to the Washington coast, but not one that covers it comprehensively. In other words, the cities of the coast, what the main forms of recreation are there, in addition to hiking, you know, kayaking, fishing, clam digging, beachcombing, birding, There's all kinds of fun things to do on the coast. So there's plenty of books like that on the Oregon coast, but I could not find one on the Washington coast. So 2009, I found myself unemployed. I knew there was a niche for a book there. And having nothing else to do, I went out and started the book.
Now, you're also a photographer, right? Because some of these pictures on the cover are amazing.
Well, I don't consider myself a photographer. When I was at the PI, I always had a photographer go with me on various trips. I was the lead writer for our outdoor section, which was called Getaways. And so I wrote the centerpiece feature for that every week. And I always had a photographer. But when digital photography came along, I started carrying my camera just because it was a Canon Rebel. Started carrying it when we'd go on assignment shooting because we'd be in these beautiful places. And of course, digital photography really made photography accessible to people. You know, you weren't burning through film. So anyway, over time, I picked up a lot of tips from the photographers. You know, they knew I had my camera and I was interested in outdoors photography for purely personal interest at the time. So they would help me out and I would ask them questions. And so over time, I think I learned a lot from them. I still consider myself a writer, not a photographer. But one of the cool things about the book is I get a lot of comments about the photos. And, you know, a photographer said 90% of photography is being there. They had a saying, something like F8 and be there. In other words, F8 is a very versatile f-stop, you know, aperture setting. And if you're there and you have it on F8, chances are you'll get a good picture. So a lot of it is not necessarily skill. It's just being there with good equipment. Anyway, people comment on the book, and I'm really fortunate that Mountaineers Books, which published the book, did such a great job on it. I mean, they went all out. The production values of the book in terms of the page layout and design, the quality of the paper, the quality of the reproduction, and the number of photos that we used, about 100, was way beyond my expectations. So I get a lot of comments about the photos. And, you know, the Washington coast is just a dramatic place. So like they say, F8 and be there.
That's great. Yeah, it's funny because I stop into Tony's shop there, Mountain Loop Books and Coffee, quite a bit, and he mentioned you were coming in, and I just couldn't even believe it because that's our plan this summer was to go out to the coast, and I had no idea where to go. And
Man,
I tell you, I know now. the book's great.
Yeah, well, I wanted to cover it all. You know, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to give a good comprehensive guide to the coast. You know, tell people what the major towns were, the history of it. And one of the things that I'm really proud of with the book is that I focused. You know, I didn't want to just say, hey, this is a really cool place, it's beautiful, go there, like a lot of guidebooks seem to do these days. Of course, I'm simplifying it. But I also wanted to talk about the physical and cultural history of the coast because it's really relevant. And what I found over time was, you know, when I began hiking, it was cool just to go see wonderful spots and be there. But over time, you become curious, like, what are those trees? You know, what's that track? You know, what critter made that track? So I think as hikers progress in their sort of hiking career, they become more interested and knowledgeable about the things that are happening in that environment. So I wanted to, you know, really focus on the cool things that had happened there culturally, because it's really it's an intense area for history. The Washington coast was one of the last, or I should say the Pacific Northwest, was one of the last pieces of continent on Earth to be charted and explored. So it's fairly recent history in terms of the people, at least European people. Of course, the native people have been there for maybe 9,000 years. So it's got a really long history. Apparently, it was on the migratory route of one or various types of people who peopled North America, the last continent for people to arrive at. And physically, of course, Olympic National Park's Wilderness Beach Strip, if you go out there, you see these sea stacks mile after mile, the Quileute Needles, the Giant's Graveyard, and you just wonder, how did that happen? Well, plate tectonics. So I wanted to tell people, you know, what has happened, important things that have happened physically and culturally along the coast, because I think it makes, when they go do a hike or visit a beach, it makes it all more relevant.
Yeah, and when you talk about the different things to do out there, you know, a lot of times people are coming all the way from the Seattle I-5 corridor out there. They're going to need a place to stay. They're going to need to maybe do something else on the way. So it's a great book.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. So tell me a couple of stories that maybe you wrote with a PI.
Oh, gosh. Well, let's see. I climbed Mount Rainier. I wrote a story about that. That was a fun one. I climbed St. Helens. I wrote stories about that. Most of my favorite stories for the PI were, you know, fun adventures that I got to go on and write about. Three Fingers Lookout. That was quite an adventurous trip. It was early in the season, so we had a lot of snow to deal with. And, of course, Three Fingers Lookout is in the most unlikely spot for a lookout you can imagine.
Yeah.
But a lot of things. You know, I was also pulled off the outdoors beat occasionally to do breaking news stories. Covered a civil lawsuit. A woman sued an NFL player for she alleged that he raped her. There were no charges brought criminally, but she sued him civilly. So I covered that. We had a helicopter crash on Mount Hood back in probably 10, 15 years ago. It was actually not a helicopter crash. It was a climbing accident. A rope team slipped and knocked another rope team into a crevasse. One person died. And then a rescue that came to pull out victims crashed itself. So I actually got in a helicopter and flew down to cover a helicopter crash.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that was a little bit weird, but
wow.
Fun. So yeah. All kinds of stories. But the ones that I remember most, are the great adventures in the outdoors.
Yeah, that's great. And did you find yourself trying to do something really extra cool when you wrote the articles? Or were you just like, okay, I need to write about this and go there? What was on your mind when you decided what you were going to write about?
Well, the cool thing about it, at least when Getaway started in 1998, I believe, was, I was the outdoors expert. So the editors of I was moved to the features department for that. Just let me go for it. You know, they just gave me a lot of rope and said, go cover it. You know, the outdoors. So basically one of my criteria for doing a story is, you know, what's a cool adventure I've always wanted to do? Like I say, climbing St. Helens, climbing Rainier, going to Three Fingers Lookout, maybe doing a Cross Cascades backpack trip, things like that. And of course I knew that I had to mix it up too, because I wanted to do a variety of things, not just hiking. You know, we did bicycling stories, kayaking stories. So I'd pick a spot on the map that was intriguing, like let's go kayak to Long Island in Willapa Bay, or let's go kayak to Lummi Island and come back via Chuckanut Bay. So, you know, being involved in those activities and talking to people on a pretty much daily basis gave me a good sense for the cool things that we have to do here in Washington, which are innumerable. I actually anticipated retiring in that job, and I could have retired in that job in a couple of years and still had a long list of things to write about.
All right, well, let's get to one of the things we like to do here is kind of find out, since you've been doing this for so long, what kind of things, what got you into this? What got you into the outdoors?
Well, that my dad and mom. My dad was a real avid fisherman. He was his main passion was steelhead fishing, you know, fishing the Western Washington rivers for steelhead trout, but he also loved salmon fishing. He'd grown up in Seattle and Bremerton, and he had an uncle, his mom's brother, my great uncle, that was really into the outdoors. And so he was active in the outdoors. My mom was a high school science teacher, natural sciences teacher. She taught botany, biology, chemistry, physics, all that stuff. And so she went to the University of Washington, you know, had some great professors, including Erna Gunther, who was an anthropology professor, wrote about ethnobotany and things like that. So she knew, you know, pretty much every genus and species in the forest, which was kind of irksome to me as a kid because, you know, we'd be hiking down a trail. I said, let's come on, let's get to the waterfall. But she'd want to stop and identify all the plants and talk about their unique qualities. So my mom and dad, the first hike I ever remember taking, I don't know where we went, but was with my dad and some of my brother and some friends. And we hiked to some lake, I'm pretty sure in the Cascades, a fishing lake. You know, we hiked to go fishing. And that's the first hike I remember. I was probably 6 or 7. And one of the things that I remember most is we were walking along this heavily forested trail, old growth, as I recall, the stream kind of tumbling, a little waterfall and stream tumbling along this trail. And So we stopped, and my dad or one of the guys in the party stuck their head in there and drank the water. And I asked my dad, is that water okay to drink? And I remember him saying, that's the cleanest water you'll ever find.
Yeah.
So we all stuck our head in the stream, of course. Since then, we know, you know, with all the people in the mountains these days, Giardia is a real issue. But back then, you know, people just drank right out of the streams and waterfalls and didn't think twice about it. So I got into hiking with my dad. And then, of course, I grew up, went to school, went to the University of Washington School of Communications. And I had a real, a great mentor in backpacking. I had never done backpacking before. But when I was working in the Daily World in Aberdeen, there was a reporter there, Bryn Bjors. This was 35, 40 years ago. To this day, he's still a good friend and hiking buddy. And he was a member of the group called the Olympians, which is a Grays Harbor-based hiking club. They formed in the 30s, and they're still going strong. And he would take off every weekend and do these crazy trips in the Olympics. And once a year, it seemed, he would go on like a week or 10-day, you know, backpack into some really remote parts of the Olympics, like the Bailey Range, the Burke Range, you know, up in the Valhallas, do these crazy trips. And he'd come back and we'd have lunch and he'd tell me all about it. And so I, you know, borrowed his expertise and learned, you know, what I needed in terms of the backpack, the gear, the boots. And then we took a hike, and oddly enough, it was out to Toliac Point in Olympic National Park's Wilderness Beach Strip. I, you know, love the ocean. So I said, yeah, let's do an ocean backpack. And so we hiked out there, I think it was May or June, and had a wonderful trip. I had bought a new pair of REI hiker boots, you know, single leather hiking boots. And I remember Bryn warned me, now break those in. So I wore them to the extent that I thought they were broken in, but they weren't at all. And so, you know, 2 days into the trip, I had blisters all over my feet.
Oh, man.
Which is a major hurdle. It's not as big a deal these days because people, you know, wear mostly nylon boots now that don't blister like the old single piece leather construction boots did. But we had a great trip. And so that kind of got my start in backpacking. I'd actually taken one backpack trip before that with my wife, again, out to Scott's Bluff on the Olympic National Park's Wilderness Beach Trip. But we were real novice. You know, we overpacked. We had cheap packs from like some cheap sporting goods store. And but Bryn, my buddy, he was into gear and he knew all about backpacking. He had long experience. He'd climbed St. Helens before it erupted. And I believe by then he'd done Rainier twice. So he's always been a real good mentor. And we've hiked all over the place now, the Southwest and the desert and lots in Washington.
Oh, those are great. Good stories, man. So what about like longest hike? What was the longest time you're out there since you had a job and a wife and everything? I mean, how much time do you spend out in the woods?
Back in the 80s, I took like a 50, 55 miler. Me and my best friend, Scott Egbert, hiked from up the Suiattle River in the Darrington area, over Suiattle Pass, down Agnes Creek to Stehekin. That was well before the Suiattle Road was blown out here 10, 15 years ago. So that was a long one. That was a fun one. It only took us like 4 days, I think. We planned to take 5 or 6, but that was a great trip. A lot of cool adventures. My longest day hike has probably been 10 so years ago, did the through hike of the Enchantments, which I think is close to 18 miles. And then let's see. With Bryn, my wife and I, Bryn and his girlfriend, now wife, we did Paria Canyon in Utah and Arizona a few years ago. That's in the Paria Canyon Vermilion Cliffs Wilderness. It's starts out as kind of a slot canyon, very very narrow canyon with steep red rock walls. And as you near the Colorado, it opens up. It's just an absolutely stunning part of the planet. So I think that's 30 miles, something like that.
Wow. Yeah, I've heard of people doing that day hike in the Enchantments. That sounds like a pretty extreme trip.
It is. You know, we did it in October. And so we started out, we went in via Kolchuk Lake. Two approaches, you know, the Kolchuk Lake approach and then the Snow and Nada Lake approach on the other side. So we started out with headlamps and hiked up from Kolchuk through Asgard Pass, which is a real steep grunt, and then came down through the Enchantments and Snow and Nada Lake and finished the hike with headlamps. It was cool, though.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good memory.
Yeah, it was beautiful. The larch were, you know, were totally golden and everything was really pretty. I backpacked the enchantments as well too over, you know, 4 or 5 day period. So that's, you know, a real exquisite spot.
Oh yeah. What about scariest moment on the trail?
Well, one time there's been two, one on the coast and one in the enchantments. The time I backpacked the enchantments, we came in the Snow and Lotta Lakes approach and we camped at, I think, Snow or Nada Lake, whichever is the first one along the trail. And then in the morning, we shouldered our packs and climbed up into the enchantment lakes themselves. Found a lake. I can't remember which lake it was, but one of the prettier lakes up there, the second or third you come to. And it was a beautiful day, probably 80 degrees, not a cloud in the sky. Absolute gorgeous sunny day. So we looked around for the best site at that lake, and we found a spot. Got ready to pitch the tent, but you know, Scott and I looked at this spot and it was in a little bit of a depression. And I mentioned to Scott, I said, you know, if it starts raining or anything, that depression could fill up with water. But you know, the weather was ideal. I mean, you couldn't ask for any better weather. So we put the tent down and I think we fished the lake and we're just lounging around camp and laying around in the sun, enjoying the ambiance of the place. And all of a sudden from the western horizon, these huge, black, ugly clouds. The whole sky filled with black clouds, and it gradually moved over to us. And for the next hour, hour and a half, had the most outrageous thunder and lightning storm you could possibly imagine. You know, we're at what, 7,200 feet, and this August thunderstorm rolls through. And so, fortunately, the place we were, the tent was in, was not near any, you know, high objects like, you know, rock peaks or trees. So we got in the tent and sat on our pads. Well, it was also rained like crazy. It was thunder and lightning coming down so hard that we could smell the electricity. I mean, we could see lightning bolts coming down 50 yards away through the windows in the tent.
Wow.
And so we just sat there. We had a bottle of whiskey or something. So we sat there and chugged on that bottle while this thing raged. It got raining so much that depression where we'd pitched the tent totally filled up and the water ran off. So we could see little rivulets under the tent, you know, rolling. Is it must've rained an inch, you know, in an hour and a half. And it was just crazy. It was I'd seen one other thunderstorm that was pretty dramatic. That was in Iowa. That was back in the early 70s when I hitchhiked across America. But this one, we were at 7,200 feet or 7,100 feet. And so, it was like we were right in it. But then, you know, after an hour and a half, it passed. It was sunny, 80 degrees again, absolutely gorgeous. So we crawled out of the tent. We picked the tent up, poured a little rain out that had seeped into it and moved it to a different spot. By then, of course, we were pretty well hammered because we had that bottle of whiskey.
Yeah.
So that was a scary trip. And then just a few years ago, my wife and I were camping at Pinnacle Rock Campground on Long Island. Long Island is in the Willapa National Wildlife Refuge in Willapa Bay, uninhabited, absolutely rampant with wildlife. A lot of bears, elk, deer, waterfowl, and aquatic birds everywhere. And so one night, I like to go there on moonlit nights. I just like the big full moon. And so we were there, I think, in May. And moon was full. We climbed into our tent, you know, around 9 or 10. And about 2 in the morning, for some reason, we were both awakened. And we could hear these, like, soft footprints and a humming. It was a humming. And I relate this in the book, too. It sounded like a woman walking along the shore. We were camped right at Pinnacle Rock Campground, you know. Well, with the tide out, we were probably, you know, 300 feet from the water. With the tide in, we were 30 feet from the water. So this humming kept getting a little bit louder, and it sounded exactly like a woman humming. And we could hear the footprint. As it approached our tent, the humming stopped, but we could hear the footprints. It went past our tent, past the campfire. Our campfire was still probably smoldering, over to our kayaks, and then turned around and went past our campsite. So I unzipped the tent and yelled, you know, "Who are you?" And then we could hear crashing in the woods. As it scampered off. But, you know, I swear it sounded like a woman humming, but when it crashed off into the woods, I thought, what the hell was that? So we just didn't know. Our hearts were pounding though. So I called the manager of the refuge when I got back. I actually emailed him. I said, I can't remember, it's Charlie. Charlie, did you have any researchers on the island? You know, my first thought was maybe they had a researcher, because people do studies on the island because it's uninhabited and it's so full of wildlife. In fact, when I worked on the Daily World, I did a story on a Utah State grad student who was studying the island's bear population. So I asked him, Charlie, was there anybody on the island? You know, I thought maybe doing nighttime studies of nocturnal animal activity, you know, because a lot of animals are nocturnal. Nope, nobody camped there at all. So we never could really figure out what happened, what it was. However, when we arrived there by kayak, we saw a bear scat not far away, about 100 yards from the campground. And when I did that story with the Utah State grad student, he told me that the black bear density on Long Island was greater than anywhere in North America other than Alaska. So all I can imagine is it was a bear, you know, walking along the shore in the moonlight. Why it was humming like a woman, I don't know. But I do know bears are capable of making really intriguing noise. So that was kind of a scary one.
That sounds real scary. Jeez.
Yeah. You know, and we went back there too just a couple of years ago, again in spring. I go in spring because some of the campgrounds you can shuck oysters and dig steamer clams. So springtime's a good time for that. But we went back and we hiked from Pinnacle Rock. We kayaked in, camped there, and then we hiked ashore from there to Smoky Hollow Campground, which is just north, both on the west side of the island. And we ran into a couple, a young man who is a Coast Guardsman stationed at Astoria and his wife. And there's at all of the campgrounds on the island, there are composting toilets. And they said that they had stowed their food. They didn't have bear canisters, so they'd stowed their food in the composting toilet. I mean, not in the toilet, but in the structure. And that a bear had come and tried to get in there in the middle of the night. So, and I know there's a lot of bears there. So I think what we heard that night was a bear.
Well, it would have been nice to know. I tell you, that's one of the things. I've had a bear go by my tent at the night during the night, but I knew what it was, you know. But but man, not knowing what it is and hearing that humming, it's like, oh geez.
It was so strange, you know. I'm laying in my sleeping bag and I'm thinking, why? We'd only seen one other person on the island the whole trip. I'm thinking, why would a woman in the middle of the night, this was like 1 or 2 a.m., be walking the shore by our camp? You know, I couldn't figure it out. Well, probably a bear.
Yeah, wow. All right, what about a funny story? I guess that's kind of right in there with a funny story too.
Yeah, well, you know, on that same trip to the enchantments where we got up and where we got up to the lake and had the thunderstorm, the second day we camped at, I think, Nauta Lake first, and we were hiking past Snow Lake before you do, you know, the huge climb up in the Enchantments Basin. And as we approached the lake, we saw a tent camp not far from the lake. This was early in the morning. We got up early, probably, I don't know, 6 by 7, we're on the trail. And it's not far from Nauta to Snow. So we approach it, and the tent is about 30 feet off the trail. So we had to go right by it. Well, as we approached it, apparently there were two people in that tent, and one of them, a female, was in the throes of passion. And I mean vocally so. And I couldn't figure out at first because we, you know, as we walked by, we could hear it, and we got closer. I thought it was an animal or something. Well, it wasn't an animal. So we get up to the tent, and yeah, there was a couple, like I say, in the throes of passion. And, you know, I remember hesitating a little, and my best friend Scott, who was my hiking buddy, I hesitate. I'm in front of him, and he starts pushing me and says, "Come on, let's go, let's go." So that was a real funny one. A story we tell to this day, and that was back in the probably late '80s, early '90s.
Yeah, man. Yeah, if the tent's rocking, don't come knocking. Huh?
Exactly right. Yeah, they didn't put a sign out to say that, though.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, it was funny.
Oh man, I've never come across that myself.
Nope, I never have either. Not since.
What kind of stuff do you normally carry on a hike? Do you carry the tent essentials? What's in your pack when you go just like on a day hike?
Well, it depends on the day hike. You know, in the winter, my wife and I do a lot of hiking. We live in the Juanita area, Finn Hill, a part of Kirkland. And we're really blessed here to have, you know, wonderful parks. We have Double O Denny Park, which is a Kirkland city park with, you know, nice, great, big old growth trees. We have Big Fin Hill Park, which is a county park, very wooded. It's got several miles of trail. And then St. Edward State Park, which has, you know, another 5, 6, 7 miles of trails. So really, we can walk out our door and probably get an 8 mile hike in, and 90% of it be in the forest. So a lot of those, you know, we'll do 3 to 5 milers and we won't carry anything. You know, we'll just, you know, have a rain jacket if it's a little misty or rainy, or if it's really rainy, we won't go. You know, our hiking boots and clothes, you know, warm clothing, because it's suburbia, you know.
Yeah.
There's no way we're going to get lost. We're, you know, we have our cell phones, coverage everywhere, and there's houses, you know, surrounding these forests. So, you know, there's not like any real danger. So we won't carry the tent essentials at all. We just carry our, you know, our boots and what we're wearing. Not even water. You know, a lot of times we'll just tank up on water before we go. Some of the parks, like Denny, there's water fountains. So we don't worry about it. But if it's anywhere in the wilderness, like if I'm out hiking, let's say from Rialto Beach to Hole in the Wall or Chilean Memorial on the Olympic National Park's Wilderness Beach Strip, yeah, I'll carry a day pack, and it'll have all the tent essentials in it for sure.
Okay. What about backpacking? What do you carry for like a tent?
I think we have an REI quarter dome, and you know, which is really light and functional, keeps the water out pretty well. And you know, we have a Therm-a-Rest sleeping pads. I use a pocket rocket for a backpack stove.
Oh, nice.
I don't like freeze dried much. We typically don't do, most of our hikes are, you know, 2-3 nights, except when we do things like Perea. But I don't like to carry freeze dried food. So we'll carry things like, well, gort, smoked salmon, maybe some sausages. If we can build a fire, and I do like fires, that's one of the cool things about the coast. Is there's so much driftwood and wood debris on the coast. You're allowed to have a fire.
Do you have to get a permit for that?
Nope. There's only one place on the coast in Olympic National Park where you can't build a fire, and that is the Ozette, the southern part of the Ozette Triangle in the north part. And the reason being is that's such a popular place. In fact, you need to get a permit to even camp there in the summertime. But over the years, people have burned a lot of the wood. And one of the things about the Ozette area is it's ringed by reefs and islands, so not as much driftwood washes up. So the wood supply can be limited. The big piles of driftwood we find on the beaches in the Washington coast are also habitat. You know, birds, all kinds of critters live there, sand fleas. So you can't build a fire then. But most places you can. A place like Perea Canyon, Vermilion Cliff in the desert, no, you can't. Alpine Lakes Wilderness, pretty much not. But if we're going to be in a place where we can have a fire, we'll bring like, you know, summer sausages or something, hot dogs, even things like that. So I try to avoid the freeze-dried. I'll often bring a couple freeze-dried dinners, you know, that kind of sit at the bottom of the, well, if it's a bear canister is required there or in our backpack. As just emergency food. So, and I carry full rain gear, you know, I have full Gore-Tex rain gear, a jacket with a hood and pants. And, you know, particularly in the book, some people have noted my humor in the book. You know, I think I've got a line in, talking about gear and being prepared for backpacking on the coast. You know, I have a line in there, this is not the stinking desert, damn it. It's the rainforest. So, yeah, I recommend full rain gear if you're hiking out on the wilderness coast. Good boots. I'm not a big fan of, you know, the glove kind of hiking apparel. You know, there's people who hike barefooted. That's fine if they want to do it, but not me. I want something to protect me. And if you're hiking that outer coast, you're going to be hiking on, you know, reefs full of barnacles, you know, crazy piles of kelp. Slippery stuff. You're going to be climbing up and over blow down trees, you know, from drunken forests. You're going to be doing a little bouldering, you know, skirting boulder fields. That's a place where you want to have good footwear. And also I recommend on the ocean where it's so rugged, people wear gaiters. You know, if you're going to go hike to Shy Shy Beach, say in February or March, there's a stretch of trail on the Macaw Reservation where they didn't improve the trail much, and it can be a quagmire for about a quarter mile of pure mud and water. And, you know, hiking in gravel. So, gators are really, really functional on the coast.
A little side note there. Who services that trail out there?
Well, the Macaw tribe, you used to reach Shishai Beach on an old logging road. I'm not sure if it was a logging road or a military road, because there used to be Coast Guard gun emplacements or observation posts along that bluff above Shishai Beach, above Portage Head, actually. So you used to approach it along that old road. Well, the tribe that's on the Macaw Reservation, the tribe about the late 80s, early 90s, found some liability issues. There's some private landowners that own part of that, and their lawyers advised them, yeah, you can't have the public there. You know, you could open yourself up to a lawsuit. So the tribe sought to – the tribe and Olympic National Park, because the trail reaches the national park after a mile or so, they got together and got a state grant, I think, from Interagency Committee for Outdoor Recreation. They got a $60,000 grant to reroute the trail. And they did. They put it on all tribal land that begins – they built a nice trailhead, begins in an old clear cut, and then goes through, you know, typical – hemlock cedar forest, and then reaches that old road, but it bypasses the private property. I think they ran out of money, you know, and so they left a several hundred yard stretch that they didn't improve from, you know, the southern end of the reservation to where it reaches an Olympic National Park, or right to that boundary. So, but the I believe the tribe maintains the portion that they improved. The quagmire, I don't think it gets maintained.
One thing I was curious about, what about a sleeping bag? What do you carry for that?
I think I have an REI brand sleeping bag, and it's rated 35 degrees. I have another warmer one, too, that I've had for years and years. It's rated at 20 degrees that I'll take if it's, you know, any chance of chilly weather. I will say, though, my 35-degree bag I got primarily because, you know, hiking the coast, you don't usually have real hard freezes. In the winter, it will, of course. We do get occasional hard freezes, but usually 35-degree bag is sufficient for the coast. But one trip I did was in, I want to say, February, March. We were camped at Norwegian Memorial on the coast, which is south of the Lake Ozette area. And I was in tent by myself with my 35-degree bag, and I was cold all damn night. I think I put on all my long underwear, my synthetic long underwear, you know, threw my coat over my sleeping bag. I was still cold. I got back. I looked for the temperature record for Quileute Airport, which was probably 10 miles away, and it was 15 degrees. So my 35-degree bag didn't hold up in that occasion. But by and large, it's sufficient for the coast.
Yeah, no, that makes sense, and it's lighter.
Yep.
What about, are you afraid of anything in the woods? And I'm not talking about humming ladies, because, you know, that's a, but when you, I'm talking about when you get started, when you're thinking about, okay, we're going on this hike. Are you afraid of anything out there?
No, not really. There's nothing I'm really afraid of. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of possibilities. So I urge people, if you're going on a backpack or in a place, a remote place, be prepared. You know, do carry the 10 essentials, you know, carry full rain gear, because what you want to do on the coast especially is you want to be able to bivouac for a night and not have to worry about hypothermia or anything like that. So have enough warm clothing, and by that I mean synthetic clothing, no cotton, because cotton won't keep you warm when it's wet. So synthetic gear, rain gear, you know, enough to get inside a shell, and if you need to curl up under a drift log or get in an old side an old cedar stump and wait out a nasty storm, or you know, you've broken your ankle, you can bivvy for a night and not worry about hypothermia. So you need to be prepared. But there's nothing really I'm worried about. Frankly, in some places when I was researching the book, I was more worried about two-legged critters than any real animals. There, you know, when I was researching the book, there were places where there were private property issues, or who, you know, landowner issues, I should say. A couple places that I researched that where private property owners don't want people to go, but they're really public land. And, so in some cases I packed a pistol, not because I was, you know, really afraid, but just for any possibility. But by and large, I'm not really afraid of anything in the woods. You know, animals around here, they're not going to hurt you. We have grizzly bears in the North Cascades, but they're so few. We've got an increasing wolf population, but they've never posed any problems at all to, I mean, human safety. So, of course, you know, in the Olympics now, you have to watch out for mountain goats. We had a hiker killed in the Hurricane Ridge area couple of years ago by a mountain goat. But no, I'm not really afraid of much out there.
Well, but at least you got you're knowledgeable about it, so that's the important part, right?
You know, I tell people crossing a street in a busy Seattle, downtown Seattle, is probably more dangerous than backpacking anywhere in Washington.
Yeah, and it's good that you say that, but I think there are still some people out there that are afraid, you know, and it's kind of nice to be able to talk about it and maybe help them not be afraid.
Well, there are people that are afraid, and we have two recent examples that just really wigged me out. We had a group of young folks hiking the Mount Si Trail recently who apparently saw a mother bear and cubs and took off running off trail and got lost, had to call for help, and King County Search and Rescue came and got them. I saw a TV a news show about it, and they said, yeah, the bears were coming after us. Well, I don't really think the bears were coming after them at all, you know, and if they don't get between the mom and cubs, there's no problem. And then within a week, there was another case of people in Cherry Creek Falls, claimed the same thing. I think these people were probably young and inexperienced and saw a bear and got freaked out and took off running, which is usually not the best thing to do.
Well, no, yeah, you get off the trail. It's not a good thing.
Well, also running from a creature, you know, if there is any kind of predatory nature of the creature, running triggers it, at least in the case of like cougar. Bears typically don't prey on people. It has happened in history. I don't think it's happened in Washington, but in D.C. and Alaska, there are, you know, numerous recorded incidents of black bears attacking people. But yeah, if they're in a predatory fashion, you do not want to run.
Yeah, my wife was real worried about that with me and the kids going out, and I told her, I said, well, look it up. And she found a really good wiki page that talked about all the bear, and it was all bears in the United States, so it included grizzly, like in Alaska and stuff. And I think since like the early 1900s or something, there was only 100 cases of death. And most of them, it would describe it real briefly, like, you know, taking a picture or trying to feed or something like that, you know, and so yeah, definitely there was only a few black bears in there.
Yeah. You know, if I haven't really hiked much in grizzly bear country, but if I did, I would be I wouldn't say I'd be afraid, but I'd be very cognizant of the fact that it's grizzly bear habitat. Grizzly bears do kill and eat people. You know, they're the biggest, baddest animal out there. And if they're hungry, they'll come and get you. You know, it's rare, but it does happen. So I think if you hike in grizzly bear country, you need to be cognizant of that fact. You know, check the reports before you take off on a trail, if there have been any bear sightings, things like that. So, but we really don't have to worry about that in Washington.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, moving on here with the hiking goals, what, you know, you covered it. You got this huge book. Awesome. You got the coast completely covered. Are you going to stay hiking out there, or do you have another area of the state or somewhere else you want to hike?
Well, you know, it's funny because we have so much good hiking in Washington. You know, I've hiked for 40 years in Washington, and I still have, you know, lots and lots of places that I have not hiked. So, you know, I don't have any specific goal, but one of them is just to keep exploring new and cool places. I love the ocean, though. I just can't stop going there. You know, when I think of pure recreation for myself, my head always goes west. You know, I love the coast. But yeah, there's, you know, a lot of great stuff. I'd like to explore, say, maybe the Pusaten Wilderness a little more, the North Cascades, the Goat Rocks Wilderness. It'd be fun maybe someday to climb Baker. You know, other lookouts, Desolation Peak. There's a lot of other places I'd like to go. And, you know, one part of the state that I've pretty much totally ignored I've lived here my entire life, almost 63 years. I've never been to the Palouse. Of course, I went to the UW, so I'm not going to go to Pullman. But I'd love to go to visit the Palouse, you know, Walla Walla, the Dayton country. We have some good friends that grew up in Dayton. I'd love to see Palouse Falls State Park, the Juniper Dunes Wilderness. So that's the wonderful thing about Washington is we've got such a diverse array of hiking opportunities. You know, we have not pure desert, but shrub steppe, semi-arid lands. We have dry side of the mountains, wet side of the mountains. We have rainforest. We have big volcanoes. We have ocean. We have Puget Sound. Puget Sound is loaded with good hikes. So, you know, it's really cool. I can't imagine living anywhere else than Washington State.
That's awesome. That, you know, you're talking about the coast. Have you done is it called the Pacific Coast Trail?
Well, the Pacific Coast Trail actually, I think it's called the Pacific Crest Trail. And it goes to the ocean, but it also basically what it does is it links the northern part of Washington, I think, with Montana.
Oh, that okay. That's the Pacific Northwest, right?
Yeah,
right. I'm at the one on Vancouver Island.
Okay. No, I have not done it. And there's another great one up there too, is the Juan de Fuca Trail.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's on the outer part of the Strait of Juan de Fuca, and then you know it goes up into the, you know, the southwestern corner of Vancouver Island, you know, the edge of the ocean. And they've got another one up there too that they've built in Clackwat Sound, I believe. I have not done those. I've had friends that have done it, and you know, they're very, very much adventurous, like our own backpacks on, you know, Olympic National Park's wilderness beaches. I don't have any desire to do them because, you know, we have the same thing here. I mean, when I'm retired, I may do them just for the sheer variety of it, but you know, I can't imagine them being any better, you know, if you were to rate them in terms of quality, than our own three backpacks on the Washington coast. So, you know, if somebody came up with a plan and said, hey, let's go do it, I would definitely consider it, but they're not necessarily on my list of goals.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, I'd just as soon go hike from Shy Shy Beach to Ozette, you know, or from Ozette to Rialto Beach, or from Second Beach to Oil City. You know, those three backpacks, you know, the north, middle, and the south backpacks on our wilderness beaches of Olympic National Park are basically where my heart lives, and they're just absolutely stunning, you know, world-class hikes. These are not local hikes. These are globally attractive hikes. The reason being is, you know, in the lower 48, you just don't get a 75-mile stretch of rugged, you know, sea stack strewn wilderness beach. It doesn't exist in the lower 48s. You know, in Oregon, Highway 101 runs the whole length of the coast. In Washington, it only follows the coast for about 10 or 12 miles in the Klayoc area. One of the things I used to hear and I still hear is Oregon coast is so much nicer than the Washington coast. And I used to say, oh, no, you don't know what you're talking about. But now I just grin and nod because the thing about the Oregon coast is it's all accessible. It's beautiful. You know, Cannon Beach area, all the sea stacks there, they're not like we have. Bandon area, wonderful beaches, dramatic scenery. But it's all accessible to everybody. You know, you can park your car right along the beach and drop down. And here we have 75 miles. You're not going to see the best of it unless you're willing to walk 5 or 10 miles. So there's a difference. We are, you know, our coast is more dramatic, I want to say, than any part in totality of the entire West Coast until you get up into Alaska, maybe. And even there, I'm not sure they have the dramatic, you know, viewscapes that we have on the north part of the coast. So it's different nature. It's more accessible in Oregon. A lot of people who don't hike will never see the best of the Washington coast. Anyway. I'm rambling. I'm not sure where I started.
No, that's good. No, and folks need to buy the book and check it out because that's for sure. That's what I'm seeing as I'm reading through it. So
There's a lot of great stuff. And if you're an avid backpacker in Washington, you need to do all three of those backpacks because they're similar, but each is you know wonderful in its own right. And you know if you have a life list of backpack trips to do, those three need to be on it.
Nice. And you mentioned in there when you retire. I bet you if we asked your wife, she'd probably laugh at that.
we're not far away from it. And you know, my buddy Bryn, who I met at the Daily World in Aberdeen, he's just recently retired. His wife is also retired, and I swear they're busier now than when he was working. You know, we used to meet him, you know, on weekdays regularly for dinner. You know, they'd come to Kirkland or we'd go to North Seattle where they lived and we'd have dinner, but they're on the go. It's crazy. They're busier now. I don't see him as much as when he was working. So maybe we'll be like that.
Yeah, I think so. Let's see here. So we talked about the fires. You know, with that, we talked about how, is it the Ozette where you can't build the fires because of the driftwood and such?
Yeah, it's on one side of the Ozette Triangle, the Sand Point side.
That's kind of basically falls into like the Leave No Trace realm then, right?
Yep. Yeah. And that's one thing that's a little bit discouraging to me on our wilderness beaches of Olympic National Park. I like to hike them in the winter, you know, the fall through spring or into spring. Long about May, they start getting really popular, and they're fabulously popular in the summer. real busy. And there are places where people can shortcut the park. In other words, there's a network of logging roads behind to the east of the Wilderness Beach Strip. The Wilderness Beach Strip in some places is only a quarter mile from the ocean inland. So there's a lot of impacts that come from those logging roads. And you can actually, if you know the way and you have a good DNR map, you can take logging roads and then get to wonderful places like Norwegian Memorial in a hike of about a quarter mile, as opposed to hiking 7 miles from the real trail at Ozette. So people bring in coolers of beer. They construct camps, you know, they cut small pole logs and construct camps with tarps. They leave tarps. There's too much garbage on our wilderness beaches of Washington. And that just kills me. I mean, these are wonderful places. We already have a lot of debris that washes in from the ocean. That's why we have the coastal cleanups, one of which is going to – no, it just happened. There's going to be another one, though. Anyhow, people need to practice leave no trace on the Washington coast. If you pack it in, by God, you better pack it out, or there's going to be a hot ring of fire in hell for you someday. I'm a little passionate about it. So I see too much garbage. I see people breaking the rules on our beaches, you know, in the popular times of the month, bringing dogs in, for example. Hole in the wall. It's north of Rialto Beach, about a mile and a half. You can have dogs on Rialto Beach up to Ellen Creek, which is about 3/4 of a mile from the parking area. Beyond that, no dogs are allowed. Well, one time my wife and I hiked up and backpacked at Chilean Memorial, which is, you know, maybe 4 or 5 miles in. Wonderful isolated spot on the coast. You know, a very cool bay ringed by reefs. We saw sea otters, eagles everywhere. Crazy with wildlife. When we came back out, just on the other side of Hole in the Wall, which is a sea arch that the trail goes through at low tide, the route, I should say, because there's no trail per se, we saw a big sea lion hauled out. Well, we went back there later, you know, a year or two later, and north of Hole in the Wall, very near where we saw the big sea lion hauled out, there was a guy with a barking German Shepherd. Clearly a violation of national park rules. I love dogs, don't get me wrong. I had a yellow lab until a couple of years ago, and she was our trail dog. You know, she hiked with us where it's legal all the time. She hiked with us, she ran with us, she swam with us. She was wonderful. Love dogs. But I believe there are places where you should not take dogs, and that is national parks. The guy had the dog up there. Dog didn't approach us, but it was barking its fool head off. The guy couldn't shut it up. I guarantee no sea lion is going to haul out on the beach there when there's a German Shepherd barking there. So there should be some areas where we leave dogs out, you know, that are protected because of the pristine nature of the habitat. It is habitat. It's not just a beautiful ocean beach. It's where a lot of critters, some of them threatened or endangered, live. And so we should have some places reserved for wildlife and for the values that exist there. Anyway, I'm really passionate about people doing the right thing on the coast, and that's another reason for the book. I wanted to teach people, or not teach people, but tell people how to approach this place intelligently and sensitively. By intelligently, I mean be aware of the history of the place, physical and cultural. We weren't the first ones here. There have been people there for 9,000 years that had remarkably complex cultures. That thrived with Stone Age technology, ingenious Stone Age technology. They lived in permanent towns, sturdy wooden houses. So we need to respect what's gone on there and what it is now, which is habitat. That's why I wanted to include the physical and cultural history and also tell people how to visit the place intelligently and sensitively. That was a major goal of the book.
Right. So the indigenous folks didn't have any blue tarps in it.
They didn't bring blue. Nope. Oh, everything they had would deteriorate naturally.
What about trail work and cleanup and stuff? It sounds like you might be involved in some of that. What have you done?
I do it pretty much every day now because I work seasonally for King County Parks. I work as a park specialist, a seasonal park specialist. Work basically from March to September. And I work out of Duthie Hill Mountain Bike Park, which is up on the Sammamish Plateau. And so we're out working on trails. Nearby is Soaring Eagle Park. I just spent a couple of days last week with what we call the bent shovel. It's like a shovel, but the blade is bent, so it's more like a scraper, and we use those to dig out drainage swales. You know, over the course of the winter, sticks, silt drains into it and fills these things up. This is how, you know, they're little small ditches on the side of the trail where water runs off, and we'll let it run into the forest. So clearing out those, I worked week before last with WTA. They're building a trail in the Grand Ridge Park, which is in our district. That's also up near the Sammamish Plateau. They're building a 2-mile. We and they are building a 2-mile trail around a water tower at the very high point of Grand Ridge. So I was up there with one of the full-time park specialists scouting the route. I think we've built about a mile and a half of the route, and we have about a half mile to go through the woods. So we're building a brand new trail up there. Grand Ridge is a wonderful park. So yeah, I pretty much, you know, 2-3 days a week, I'm out working on trails for King County Parks.
Oh, that sounds like fun. What about the
on WTA programs as well?
Oh, okay. Well, what about the, you mentioned the coast cleanup? What's that?
It's a group. Well, it's run by a group called Washington Coast Savers. I can't remember their website, but I think it might be coastsavers.org. But they used to do an annual cleanup. And my recollection was that it was in April, but I have a friend who participated in one just a few weeks ago. In fact, she and her dad, I think, were out at Rialto Beach Hole in the Wall. But, you know, we have a lot of debris, a lot of plastic debris that washes up on our beaches. It washes up on all beaches everywhere. And so their job is to go out and clean it up. You know, in the wilderness areas, they'll bag it up, and I think the park will come in with Zodiacs and haul the bags away. Other places, they'll haul it out to a trailhead, and the park will take it and dump it. But it's basically designed to get all the, you know, the ocean-borne trash that washes up on our beach. Curiously, though, I can't remember. I saw a photo, I think, on the Twitter feed of Washington Coast Savers, and somebody found a really cool glass float with the netting still around it on the cleanup. And I think it was up in the OZ area. So occasionally they'll find, you know, the Beachcomber's Prize, which is, you know, the glass floats that were used years ago by various nations to hold up their fishing nets.
Well, I know exactly what you're talking about because I saw some pictures in your book.
Yes, we found them. That's, you know, there's a lot of things to do on the coast that have nothing to do with hiking per se. Of course, if you're a beachcomber, you're going to be hiking, but the goal is to find cool stuff. You know, we look for agates, a petrified wood. Sometimes you'll find fossils if you know how, where and how to look. The glass float is kind of the beachcomber's prize. You know, they range in size from golf ball size to even bigger than a basketball, you know, like beach ball size. And they were used for decades by many nations in the Pacific Rim to hold up their fishing nets. They've been replaced by plastic, but used to be hand-blown glass floats. Japan was the biggest producer, and they're still out there floating around the Kuroshio and Pacific currents. And if you get a strong storm, especially a northwesterly flow for a couple of days, they get pushed out of the currents and they wash up on our beaches. And so I think I've found probably 8 to 10 over the years. And I also like them, so I've also purchased some. So I have a collection now of about 20. Yeah, I think it's coastsavers.org, but they're a great group. Their whole job is, it's a national group, but we have, you know, a local chapter, I guess. And they do two cleanups now, maybe even three. They also have started cleanups now on the south end of our coast around 4th of July weekend, because particularly this last 4th of July, when we had a drought situation throughout Washington, a lot of counties and municipalities that don't already ban fireworks did. So one of the places where people could still shoot off fireworks was like the Long Beach Peninsula, the Ocean Shores, and Westport Tokeland stretch. These are beaches where you can mostly drive. That's a whole nother issue maybe we can get into sometime. But they're very accessible beaches, and they, you know, with a drought situation, firing the fireworks into the ocean, you know, might be questionable from an ecological perspective, but from a fire safety perspective, it's fairly safe. So I read some ungodly number, like 5 or 20 tons of fireworks debris was picked up off the Ocean Shores beaches on the weekend after 4th of July.
I remember seeing some of those pictures too.
So, yeah. So Yeah, they have 4th of July specific cleanups, and then they have their typical annual cleanup that is coast-wide, north to south. And they may have more. I need to go to their website and check, because in my recollection, most of their annual cleanups were in April, but they just did one, so they may have another. But if you want to volunteer, and that's another thing, there are all kinds of volunteer opportunities on the coast, whether it's working with the Olympic Coast National Marine Sanctuary has volunteer opportunities. Coast Savers has opportunities. There is a program out of the University of Washington, the name of which escapes me, but it's a seabird study program. And what volunteers do is they volunteer to check a specific stretch of the beach, and they go to an orientation where they are trained to look for things, primarily dead seabirds. We have various issues with seabirds dying along our coast periodically. So they'll walk a mile stretch of beach, you know, once a month over a year. And, if you Googled University of Washington seabird study, you'd find it. But that's a cool program that a lot of people have had fun with. The neat thing about that is you go to a specific stretch of beach over time repeatedly, so you really get to know it. Sometimes these people will find floats and things too, but the ostensible purpose is to, you know, document and have a baseline of data on seabird mortality along our coast. So yeah, if you are kind of the bent to volunteer, a lot of great opportunities on our coast.
Yeah, it sounds like it. What about your old articles? Are they how do people find you online? Or do you have anything like maybe your old PI articles anywhere they could find or anything like that?
You know, unfortunately, the seattlepi.com has been purging a lot of its archives. So a lot of them are not there. Sometimes they are there, but I've searched for a lot of them and they're not there. I have hard copies of all of them, but I have a Twitter feed, GP Johnston. You can contact me through that on Twitter. So that's a good way. I don't really want to give out my email address or anything, but go to Twitter and do a search for GP Johnston. I will pop up and you could send me a message that way.
Great. It's the time of the podcast that we ask our guests some questions. They don't know these questions. They've never heard them before. So let's see what they have to answer. But first, let's talk about Cascade Hiker hats and bumper stickers. Go to CascadeHikerPodcast.com. Check out the hats and bumper stickers. Support the podcast. You can also donate. There's a donate button on each of our show notes. Go there, find pictures of our guests. Now enjoy the rest of the show. When you're out hiking, what piece of gear do you consider not replaceable? Or what kind of gear maybe you carry that people just think you're weird for carrying it?
I pretty much typical stuff. I don't really carry anything weird. You know, like I don't carry an umbrella like some people do when it's raining. I think that's a good idea. I just don't. I just wear full rain gear. So there's nothing odd that I carry. I used to know a guy. I actually didn't know him, but I knew his wife. He would carry, you know, those kind of, even on backpack trips in the mountains, he would carry those kind of folding aluminum beach chairs. He would actually strap one on the outside of his backpack. So when he got to camp, he'd have a nice chair to sit in. You know, they probably weigh a pound and a half. Like plastic mesh is the material you sit on, but it's, a tubular aluminum, those folding chairs.
Oh, yeah, the old, yeah.
Yeah, and I used to find that really strange, but I'm pretty much typical. I wouldn't stand out from any other hikers.
But do you filter all your water on the trail nowadays?
Pretty much, yeah. Yep.
What type of filter do you use?
I think it's it's an older one. It's not one of the newer ones, but I can't remember the brand of it. I'd have to go check. But
it's a pump.
It's a typical pump. Yeah.
Okay.
And you know, I should say on the coast, you really need to pump. The Ozette area, for example, is rampant with Giardia. It's so rampant with Giardia that the Olympic National Park installed an ozone treatment water system in their wells at Ozette because their rangers kept getting Giardia. My daughter, who's now grown up, when she was a little girl, about 3 or 4, we drank some water at a cafe in the Nia Bay area and she got Giardia. So that Ozette Nia Bay area is crazy with Giardia. You really need to filter the water or boil it. Boiling it is real cumbersome. So yeah, bring a filter. I've never had any problem. And like I say, when I first hiked with my dad, we'd stick our head in the stream.
Yeah.
Drink right out of it. But today, yeah, it's wise to filter.
No, that's good. Yeah, I remember doing that with my dad too, growing up.
Yep, back in the day.
Trekking poles. Do you use trekking poles?
You know, on the beach, a lot of times I don't, because a lot of what you're doing is you need your hands. You know, like if you're climbing over a bouldery reef, I like to have my hands free in case I slip and need to brace myself, or if I'm climbing up over a ledge, you know, because the tide's in a little bit on the reef, I want to have my hands free. For a while, I was hiking with one pole. You know, I also, when I was working on the book, would always have my camera right around my neck. So I'd only use one pole, so I'd have one hand free for the camera. But on mountain trails, for sure I do. They're really handy, especially on the descent. You know, you can extend them out and they give you a couple more touch points and really help save the knees, I think. And also when you're climbing like St. Helens, you know, really steep pitch, you know, or you're getting into thin atmosphere, they're good to lean on the way up too.
All right. What about hiking books other than, of course, yours, which I own? What do you recommend for people? Maybe even not even guidebooks. Do you have any outdoor books that maybe nonfiction that you like to read or suggest?
Oh, gosh. Well, yes. I have a lot of them. They go way back. You know, I guess we'd have to start with Ruth Kirk, who is a longtime author, a naturalist, longtime author. Her book that she did in the early 60s, it's called The Olympic Seashore. It was published by a group, I think, associated with Olympic National Park. And it basically is about, it's kind of, I don't want to say a model, because mine does the whole coast, not just the Olympic seashore. But she also approached it from, you know, a physical and cultural and biological history of the coast. You know, a lot about the tide pool creatures, the native people, the geology. It was a small book, but it was really intriguing, and they had these great maps that showed all the routes on it. It's not, no doubt, long since out of print, because it was published in 1962. It was actually originally my mom's, I think. But that kind of set the tone for my approach for the coastal book. Then, of course, I can't talk about any hiking guides without bringing up Harvey Manning. He was a wilderness activist, climber and hiker. He is probably most famous for the Issaquah Alps. He lived on Cougar Mountain, and he, as much as anyone, is responsible for the wonderful parks we have: Tiger Mountain State Forest, Cougar Mountain Park, Squawk Mountain Park. But he is also really active in the effort to create the Alpine Lakes Wilderness, North Cascades National Park. He was very opinionated guy. For example, and I didn't agree with him on everything. He didn't like mountain bikes. He's left this planet, you know, maybe 10 years ago. But he was a wonderful opinionated writer. And one of the things that he did to promote wilderness preservation in Washington was write guidebooks. The Cascade, 100 Hikes in the Alpine Lakes. These books were written beginning in the late 1960s, not necessarily to tell people where to hike, but the goal was to get people out to these places so they would want to preserve them. So yeah, he began the 100 Hike series. He was also a model of mine in my own writing. One of the things that I found over time is when the internet came to be, guidebooks started to change. When Harvey Manning and Ira Spring were doing guidebooks for Mountaineers books, they were very opinionated, no holds barred. They had a mission, and that was preservation of wilderness. But they also wrote with some depth and color and character. You know, their hike descriptions were not short. They were long, not way long. Some of mine are probably the longest you'll ever read, you know, the wilderness backpacks on the coast. But they had depth. You really got a sense of place. And, of course, Ira Spring was a wonderful photographer, so visually they were rich. When the internet came on, I think guidebook publishers started wanting to mimic the internet, which was not a lot of depth. All kinds of bells and whistles, but not a lot of text, not a lot of depth. People, you know, they thought, people just want to know where to go, what the mileage is, what the elevation gain is, how to get to the trailhead. They want the basics. So let's not waste time on the trail descriptions. Well, I thought that was the total wrong approach. So I wanted to diverge from that in my guidebook and go back to the standard that was set by Harvey Manning and Ira Spring, where you got a real sense of place. You got a sense of the importance of a place, why it was important. You know, they'd have, if they're little side trips on a hike, they would tell you about them. You know, when you reach the forks, take the one to the right. It'll take you to an overlook or an old mining claim. Well, the new guidebooks didn't. They just had all the bells and whistles, elevation charts, no depth. So I wanted to go back to that. So Harvey started with the 100 Hike series. And, you know, if you have any of those classic books, hang on to them because those are real. Those were the groundwork, the model for a good hiking guidebook. He also wrote, trying to promote suburban hiking, a series called the Footsore books, Footsore 1, 2, 3, 4. I have all four of them. Now, a lot of those places you can't hike anymore because they built homes there. But there's a lot of cool books. So those are some of the ones. The older ones are the ones I like. Now, Mountaineers Books has a series of books. The trend towards it is one that I didn't really like, and that is the day hiking series. I didn't know why they went to day hiking. I guess the notion was that the baby boom population was getting older and they weren't backpacking anymore, so let's focus on day hikes. Well, I like to backpack. Day hikes aren't about backpacks, so I didn't like that trend. However, having said that, the day hike series are very well done. Craig Romano just came out with one on the San Juan Islands, you know, day hiking Alpine Lakes, day hiking North Cascades, South Cascades, Goat Rocks Wilderness. Those are good books for hikers, you know, especially if you're new to the area. Those are great books for, you know, hiking our local wilderness areas. Very well done. I don't like the trend to day hiking only because I'm a backpacker. I want to know about the great backpacks. Now, Mountaineers Books also has great books on backpacking, like classic Hikes of Washington, things like that. But there's a lot out there now.
Yeah, that's good. What about any books that one comes to mind for me is called A Whale Hunt by Robert Sullivan. Kind of something more like that. I don't know if you've ever read that about the macaw whaling.
I have not read that, but I've, you know, researched macaw whaling extensively for the book. Like I said earlier, they had incredible civilizations or cultures, I should say. Civilizations, you could say for sure. They were some of the most complex cultures of the Americas, you know, socially stratified. So, you know, I love that, all that history. A book I wrote recently was Astoria, and I can't remember the name of the author. Very well done. It was about, well, kind of the founding of the town of Astoria and a big venture by a New York, a rich New York industrial, or not industrial, so he was a trader, basically. That was a good one. I saw the movie The Revenant. You know, yeah. I like that, and I'd like to read the book. Most of the stuff I read is, you know, old historical accounts. I really love the history of places, like Lewis and Clark journals is a wonderful read, you know, in various forms. Like to read about like Vancouver's adventures. Of course, for the research of the book, I tried to find everything I could about the fur traders and the explorers like Vancouver. James Cook, he named Cape Flattery. So I love the historical accounts. I'm more a nonfiction reader than fiction.
That's great. What about Three Fingers book?
I haven't read the Three Fingers. I've hiked there. There is a cool book about lookouts, though, in Washington called Poets on the Peaks.
Oh.
Also can't remember the name of the author, but we had some really famous, you know, kind of beatnik poets. Jack Kerouac. He spent a couple seasons as a lookout at Desolation Peak. Oh, gosh. The others I can't remember. But there are two or three of his cohorts that that manned peaks in the North Cascades, the name of one of which is, he's still alive and he's wonderful. And I can't remember his name, but he's a poet. He spent one, I think, on Sock Mountain, spent a season. So this book is all about these beat poets and writers who spent time, I think largely for inspiration. Kerouac wrote about his time up there, Desolation Angels, which is, you know, some pretty wacky stuff. I mean, really interesting, cerebral stuff.
I'm sure.
So that's a cool one.
I'm going to have to check that out for sure. Yeah, I'll put links to all these books. I'll find them and get some links up on the show notes too.
Yeah, Poets on the Peaks is a real cool one.
Great. All right, well, last question. Do you listen to any hiking podcasts?
I'm going to now.
Good.
I don't really know. I don't want to say I'm anti-technology, but as you probably have gathered, I look in a skeptical way at a lot of things digital, the internet. You know, the internet has killed the newspaper industry, basically. I lost my job because of it. So, and like I say, it tends to be, you can find depth on the internet now. In the early years, it was really hard, but it tends to be short, you know, quick hits. And I see a lot of, for lack of a better word, bullshit on the internet. And Facebook is a classic example. People are always posting these, you know, videos and pictures that are pure hoax, you know. There's so many hucksters on Facebook trying to sell stuff in, you know, obscure, you know, unhealthy ways. Anyway, I look at that, you know, try to look at it skeptically.
Yep.
I haven't even really gotten into podcasts. One of my coworkers is really into podcasts. So I will.
Good. All right. Well, hey, thanks for coming on the Cascade Hiker podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Rudy. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much for listening to the show. Go on back to CascadeHikerPodcast.com and, you know, leave me a comment. Tell me what you thought. That's how I know everything's going good, or maybe some things are going bad. But maybe you have some ideas there. And if you have some more questions for any of our guests, leave a comment under their episode, and maybe we can get them back on and answer some quick questions there. You can send me an email if you don't want to leave a comment. It's ibighiker@gmail, ibighiker@gmail. Give my Facebook page a like, North Cascade Hiker. Follow me on Twitter, @N_CascadeHiking. That's @N_CascadeHiking. I try to give you guys multiple ways to get a hold of me. Give me some comments on the show and maybe some ideas for some guests. Thanks again for listening to the show. Here's a little bit more of that Whiskey Fever track, Tall Grass.
You were sweet like honey on a heartbeat. You were fine like wine in the sunshine. I could feel you coming on strong. Could never be wrong, could never be wrong. See her laying down in the tall grass, playing mandolin in a white dress. So come running when I hear that song. It could never be wrong, it could never be wrong. Where you wanna run, baby, I'll run too. I would leave this world for a beautiful girl if I could just find